This is take two, side one, Ed Quaid interview, 2/18/88. You were talking about moving over to the mathematics.
Yeah, so I moved over to the mathematics division. I don't exactly remember the date, but within the 6 months or so after I'd been there.
Well, so this was fairly quick then.
Yes, this was fairly quick. The mathematics division was run on a very disorganized fashion in the sense that everybody worked individually. They might work on a project, but there were no groups in which the way they were in the aircraft division, where everybody belonged to a particular kind of group, which might be armament, might be airframes, might be this and that, something related. And there were periodic reports and group leader meetings and things like that.
Most of the people in my study so far that were in the aircraft division came from the aircraft industry. Did you sort of see this as a reflection of the way they sort of carried over their experience of doing things from the industry?
I think that's right. I saw it that way. Why I went to the aircraft division in the first place, I don't really know. I have no idea how I turned up in Gene Root's division.
So the character of the mathematics department was substantially different.
Yes, that's right. It depended on the character of John Williams more than any other characteristic, I think. He just did things in a different way.
Was this more like a university department? Was that
Yes, much more like a university department than an industrial department.
So how did you decide on areas to work on once you came to the mathematics department? Obviously, you were still interested in this question of developing suitable models for the study that Paxson was working on and then that you continued.
Well, you really decided on your own. That was mostly what you did. I was still working with Paxson, and later I was, several years later, I was actually assigned by John Williams to be Paxson's deputy in another study because he was afraid that, if anything happened to Paxson, why this particular study, which involved a study of limited war and involved 6 or 8 consultants from the Army, Navy, Air Force, so on, were hired, that if anything happened to Paxson, why, they wouldn't know anything about the study, and so on. So they had to have some sort of a body in there, a deputy, and I agreed to do that. Yeah. But no one ever said that I should work on linear programming or game theory, or that was just left entirely up to me what I wanted to do.
What was John Williams' reaction to this idea of systems analysis? What did he think of it as a method for working out these problems of uncertainty and answering complicated questions that the military was interested in?
I think he thought it was a good idea, but that uh, but that it was a, something that required more judgment and less calculation, more deep thought and debate rather than the idea that you could lay out a plan and assign tasks and get the thing done that way, that it required more consultation and talking it over. And and that type of approach, more debate and deliberation than just sitting down and trying to calculate everything.
Yeah. Besides yourself, who was a mathematician and assisted on some of these early studies, and Paxson seems to be a fairly important person in terms of initiating some of these early systems analysis studies. Was anyone else in the mathematics department actively working with people in the aircraft division or in other areas where these systems analysis studies were going on? Or were you the principal person who was relating to these kinds of studies?
Oh, yes, there were other people working. But there weren't very many in the mathematics department who were as absorbed in systems analysis work as I was. There were we started, for example, an air defense study sometime 1950 or so, in which I think Bob Speck worked with that.
What then were your kind of evolving views of the systems analysis? You've given some kind of indications. You went up in this early study you worked on with Paxson. You went up to Inverkern and saw that this problem that you're working on was a non-problem. And then as you moved towards the Wallstetter study, you began to kind of simplify your approaches in terms of variables for which you didn't have good information on. So what was your evolving sense of where systems analysis might go from this early effort that you and Paxson worked on?
Well, you see, I'm still working on systems analysis today. I mean, I'm about to, well, I'm just proofreading a book. I've got the first 8 chapters of a new book sitting on my desk there. They arrived yesterday that I have to proofread, which is the second volume in a 3-volume handbook of systems analysis, which I'm doing with Hugh Miser. See, after I after I'd been at RAND several years, I was assigned the problem of putting together a series of lectures on systems analysis for the Air Force.
This would have been about what time frame?
Well, the lectures were first given in 1955, and I was assigned the task a year or so before that. It became clear that if you're going to do systems analysis, you needed an educated client. That is, if the client didn't understand what you were doing, why, you probably wouldn't make much progress with it. So you needed to educate the client.
By this point, had the Air Force become either disillusioned or cautious about the systems analysis approach? I mean, is that part of the reason for this?
Well, I don't think they were. I don't think they were disillusioned. They were just. They were. We had to disabuse them of the belief that that with systems analysis you could actually prove, you know, that this bomber was better than that bomber. The belief had built up in a great many of these people that while this was a useful technique, you couldn't establish this as scientific fact by studies like this. There was always going to be a great deal of chance that what you were doing might be wrong. There were all sorts of errors that could be made, that it wasn't just black and white. And in fact, the subject of these lectures was more to tell them that systems analysis is a fine technique, but listen, there are all sorts of things that you got to watch out for. There are pitfalls. There are errors that can be made. There can lead you into the wrong conclusions and so forth. We had to. I think that really the first lectures were to disabuse the Air Force of their idea that that systems analysis was the perfect tool.
Was this to get them to view the RAND studies in perspective as well as, say, industry studies?
Was it? That's right. It was to view the RAND studies in perspective and industry studies. For example, the letter I got from Leroy Brothers, who was the head of Air Force Ops Analysis. After this series of lectures was that in his opinion that what these lectures did was made the Air Force more receptive to analytic studies, better appreciate them, and more receptive to having the people in his group who worked directly with the Air Force. Gave him a better reception and more inclined to listen to him and so forth. And we talked a lot about the limitations of systems analysis in these lectures.
How long a period did this course or series of lectures go on?
1 week. 1 week, two lectures a day for 5 days. Yeah. And then we repeated it again. Well, we did it for a week and for the following week, and then again in a year or so, we did it for the Department of Defense as a whole. That is Army, Navy, Department of Defense people, as well as Air Force.
Who were the people that these lectures were directed at? Who was your audience?
Well, these were the first audience was mainly Air Force officers and analysts associated with the Air Force. And they ranked from, up through general. Brigadier General, so on. Colonels, mostly. few very bright captains like Pasfar and so on in the first group.
And the reception to these lectures was?
Was positive, yes. Yes. And it resulted in this analysis for a military decision. This was a book. Took 5 years to clear the book. I mean, we first put out a set of lectures notes, which was classified secret. It was a RAND, in a RAND series called S-25, I think that was. And then eventually we published the unclassified book.
Yeah. In terms of the Air Force putting these kinds of study into perspectives, being able to effectively utilize them, I think at one point in either the Pitfalls or in this book, I think a statement was made that the decision makers didn't need to know how to do a systems analysis, but they needed to understand its general character. Is that a statement you still feel is accurate, or did I set that viewpoint out correctly?
I think that's pretty close to, they don't know how to do it in detail, but they do know how to, they must know something about the general character of it.
I wonder, a kind of analogy there is when you have someone who's in a technical management position, say in an aircraft company, generally you want that person to be capable in the type of engineering activity that they're overseeing. I wonder if there's any analogy there in the sense that a person who uses systems analysis really needs to be able to, if not necessarily perform one, have almost a pretty technical level understanding of what's going on.
Yes, I think he does need that technical level understanding of what's going on to really appreciate what the analysis does. But he doesn't have to be able to carry out all the mathematics that might be involved and so forth.
So I guess the question is, when you talk about a educating your client, what level of education are we talking about?
Yes, you're not talking about a very detailed level of education, but you're trying to teach him what's generally involved in the analysis, that the sort of things that you take into consideration, how you compare alternatives, and how you decide between various possibilities, which are better than others, how schemes that you use to rank them, and things like that.
I think it might be useful at this point to kind of run through some of the ideas that come out in your book, Analysis for Military Decisions, that's based on the series of lectures. First of all, at this point, I mean, the systems analysis started out in this initial Paxson study as a not altogether precise idea of what it is one was doing, what systems analysis meant. And I wonder whether, by the time you deliver these lectures, you could kind of offer up a definition of what systems analysis was.
Well, I think we do offer a definition in there, which I would still very likely stick with in most of the details of what we say.
Can you kind of encapsulate that definition for us for the tape here?
Well,
if you'd like, we could pause and look at the book for a second to.
Why don't we pause just a minute?
Okay. Read this for the record. I'm looking at Dr. Quaid's book, Analysis for Military Decisions, and we're on page 4. And it says here, systems analysis might be defined as inquiry to aid a decision maker choose a course of action by systematically investigating his proper objectives, comparing quantitatively where possible the costs, effectiveness, and risks associated with the alternative policies or strategies for achieving them, and formulating additional alternatives if those examined are found wanting. Now that's the basic definition.
That's right.
What's interesting about that to me, though, is that it leaves a very wide latitude in terms of methodology.
That's
right. Which you approach these questions of uncertainty. How does the systems analysis analyst decide what the best methodology is for a given program, for a given problem? Tell me if these questions are kind of off the mark, and we'll.
No, the question is not off the mark. What he does is usually a systems analysis arises when somebody faces a problem situation. But he knows that something is wrong and wants to improve the situation, but doesn't know exactly what it is, say, or how to go about improving it. And so the first thing you do, if you're going to do a systems analysis, is to look at that problem situation and see whether you can extract a problem out of it. That is, something that you can grasp and get hold of, and that which, if you can find a solution to it, will be helpful to the man that you're trying to help. And you may find that there are several problems in a problem situation. That is, usually you start with what's mainly a mess, and try to extract a definite problem out of it. And you go about that problem by first considering what you're trying to accomplish, what the objectives or goal are in that. And once you've decided on the goal, the objectives guide you to the possibilities, the alternatives. That is, once you decided what to do, you consider what are the possible ways that you might go about doing this. And these things you would call alternatives. Now, the next thing you want to do is to evaluate these alternatives. And the idea is to find out the circumstances under which, say, alternative A is superior to alternative B. That frequently depends upon things over which you have no control, over the external circumstances. And once you've done that, and this requires usually that you make some kind of assumptions about the future, you know, under which these alternatives are going to operate. Then you are able to say to the man who makes the decision that that if you take alternative A, and such occurs, why, this is likely to happen. If you take B and such occurs, C is likely, something else is likely to happen. Then somehow or other you have to weight the possibilities of, you have to say, well, what's the most likely circumstances? Can you put probabilities on it? And then decide what's to be done. Now, you don't really hope to get a result that's absolutely clear cut. The way you hope to help your client is that is to let him know what are the things he has to consider, and what are the unlikely things. If you can really eliminate the ones that are no good, you've made a great deal of progress, and that's about all I think that you can say of this.
Let me, this is a little bit unfair since I just read this last night and you probably haven't looked at it for a long time, but there was a quote from page 247 in the book that I thought I just might read and get your reaction to. And this is about a statement relating to the uses of systems analysis. And you say, an accurate answer is that they are used extensively in dealing with related or component questions, but except in narrowly defined problems, not very much in the determination of an overall solution.
Yes, I think that's probably right. That depends on what you mean, I guess, by an overall solution, but there have been lots of very good systems analyses, some of which are have been used in overall solutions, like the like Geller's pawn study, for example.
Could you explain that a little bit? I'm not familiar with that one.
This is the study of the. Well, Holland had a disastrous flood in about 1955, and they set out to build a system of dikes and so on to protect the coast. Up until a few years ago, the one that hadn't been protected was a big inland water called the Oosterscheld, and problem arose as to how you were going to protect the Oosterscheld from flooding. And it became a very controversial issue because the original plan was to close it off from the sea. And it would have become not a saltwater inlet but a freshwater lake if you close it off from the sea. And this would change the whole ecology of the region. And people objected to this very strenuously. So three alternative schemes were proposed. One was that you were to you would dike it all around the shores. In other words, you would close it off completely at the entrance. And another was that you would build a floodgate at the entrance, which would ordinarily be open, but in case of a severe storm like caused this 1955 flood, then the gate would close, and the bee would be protected. Well, Rand got into this study to help the Dutch government decide which of these alternatives to choose. And this study was directed by Bruce Geller at Rand, and was done in cooperation with the Dutch Water Agency, corresponding to our Bureau of Engineers of Harbor and so on. And they're, and what they did is they estimated the consequences of each three alternatives, how it would affect the ecology, how it would affect the economy, what it would do to shipping, what it would do to recreation, simply what the consequences would be for each of these, and what it would cost. And this, the results were presented to the Dutch Parliament, who voted to adopt the most expensive plan, which was really to build this gate, the floodgate, the dam with a gate that could be closed in terms of a storm. And I say that was a very successful analysis, because the Dutch government then followed on with a plan, with a request for Rand to supply a water management plan for the Netherlands as a whole, not just merely to protect from flood, but how to manage water so they would have an adequate supply of drinking water, of water for agriculture, and of water to flush away the waste and the so forth. And that study is also done by Geller, a very successful study. They've submitted a very complicated set of plans. The government has to choose among the various possibilities.
In Geller's study to handle this flooding problem, did that make the recommendation for the gate approach?
No, they didn't actually make the recommendation. They did the study without a recommendation. All they did is list the consequences, leaving it up to the Dutch to decide which to do.
And the consequences were probably, I don't know, a certain number of variables where they listed the potential.
Yes, they prepared a very fancy thing they called a scorecard, which laid out in each of these sectors, like the economy, recreation, and so on, how it would affect these would affect the results. Yes.
Resuming our discussion after a brief pause, I'm wondering, you cite this as an example of a good systems analysis.
Yes.
And I wonder what the factors are in your assessment of its quality. Is it the rigor and thoughtfulness with with which it was executed? Or in addition, is it because it led to this larger consideration of which this flood question was a part?
No, I had decided this was a good study before I even heard about the second study. It was in the thoroughness of what the original study was about, and in about his decision not to try to make a recommendation on this. This was such a political problem in the Netherlands that any recommendation by an outsider would have just raised hackles all over the place. So they did this completely without a recommendation as to what should be done, just presenting it and doing this without using decision theory or anything like that to weigh the three possibilities, on the theory which I hold that people can decide on what to do without deciding on their objectives. You don't have to decide on your objectives. You can decide what to do for different reasons. I think decision theory would have been a mistake to use that to make a recommendation on this study.
Correct me if I'm wrong, in your citing of Geller as a good example of systems analysis, kind of listening between the lines, I got the impression perhaps the number of good examples of systems analysis is relatively limited.
I think that's probably true, although not as limited as you might imply. I mean, there are other examples. In this book that we wrote with Miser, I cited we reviewed four studies as examples. One was a Geller study. One was the study done for the New York City Blood Bank, which we thought was a very good study. One was the RAND Fire Project work. I don't know whether you know that.
I'm not familiar with that.
This is the RAND New York City Institute work on fire. On the deployment study of there, done by Warren Walker and others on that, which I thought was a very good study. And the other study, which I have some questions about, was the YASA energy study done by the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. Are you aware of that? I should extend my biographical work just a little.
Certainly.
I retired from RAND in 1973 because I became 65 and they had a retirement at 65. I became a consultant. I'm still a consultant to RAND, but I haven't done any consulting that I've been paid for since 76, but the consultancy enables me to use the library, go in the building, and so forth. And I'm still a consultant. But after I left RAND, I did some consulting for SDC and for a couple of other outfits. System Development Corporation, for the Ballistic Missile Division. Then I, in the spring of 76, February, I went to the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna. Actually, it's not in Vienna, but it's in a little town south of Vienna. But I lived in Vienna. And became head of their systems analysis project there, which was called I forget what it was called. It wasn't called that, but that's what it was. And I was there for 3 years, and while I was there, one of the objectives of this was to develop a handbook of systems analysis, and that's the reason I went there. Is the man who had been in charge of the project for a brief time, Roger Levian, another RAND. Former RAND employee who now works for as vice president of Xerox, charge of research for him, was made director of the institute. And so he got me to come head the handbook project for him. And I was there for 3 years arguing. This is an institute which is supported by 15 different nations, and I spent my 3 years there arguing with the Russians about what to put in a handbook of systems analysis. Roughly speaking, that was the main argument on the upside.
What was their approach to this, to systems analysis? Obviously differed somewhat from yours.
That's right. This institution was started actually by McGeorge Bundy. Got the idea when back when Kennedy was president. I think you're running out of tape again.
Yeah, we got a couple of minutes. So,
he got the Ford Foundation to put up some money, and they met with a Russian member of the Russian Academy of Sciences named Gavishiani. And after a number of years, took about 10 years, they decided to set up a joint institute in which the U.S. and the Soviet Union, I think each put up about a third of the money for this, and they would then bring in other nations who would put up shares of the other third. There were roughly 15 nations in that when I went to YASA, 6 from the Soviet side, the others were Western nations of different kinds. And the reason they agreed on systems analysis was nobody knew what it meant. I mean, the Russians thought systems analysis meant one thing, the French thought it meant something else. We were pretty clear on what it meant to us, you know. And so it was called the Institute of Applied Systems Analysis. Now, for the French, systems analysis means the analysis of systems. For the Russians, it means essentially systems theory.